Hello and welcome to A Grey Matter. I'm Rebecca Archer. In recent years, we've seen a growing number of sports people speak out about their experiences of head injuries, and concussions are forcing more and more athletes to take a break from or cut short their sporting careers. And research on the brains of former athletes is raising awareness of the long-term neurological damage that can be caused by repeated, apparently minor, knocks to the head. Dr. Fatima Nasrallah is currently spearheading a groundbreaking study here at the Queensland Brain Institute, investigating the long-term effects of concussion on the brain. Fatima, welcome.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Just how difficult is it to diagnose brain trauma? Is this the kind of thing that always shows up in a scan, and are there telling behaviours which reveal a person has suffered a concussion?
I think it's a bit of a tricky one, and it really depends on the severity of the concussion. You might get a severe concussion which actually is associated with significant symptoms such as dizziness, fatigue, vomiting, signs that are very obvious to a medical practitioner. But then there's no obvious damage to the skull or the head. But sometimes when there are persistent symptoms and we actually need to do a scan to determine whether there's a change, those scans often come back very normal looking, as if they're a healthy brain, and that's where it becomes hard to treat. So this would depend on the severity, it would depend on the type of concussion, and it would also depend on the individual themselves. So very tricky to tell.
So can you describe what occurs in the brain when a person has suffered a concussion? What goes on exactly?
It's defined as the symptoms that are associated with a physical hit. So if you've had a physical knock to the head, an external knock to the head is like an external case and a skull, and inside there's a lot of liquid, and inside the liquid there's a soft tissue called the brain. And so as you get a physical knock to the head, the brain starts to hit the sides of the skull inside, and it starts to move. Every time it moves, it hits different sides of the skull. And so it's just submerged in this liquid. And so depending on the severity of that hit, depending on the type of knock that you get, the hits of the brain inside the skull can be worse and tend to bruise. So every time it hits at a different area, it bruises the brain. And the symptoms that are associated with that are called concussion. And so this is why it's very hard to manage, because we can't see where those bruises are.
So in that case, how do we know when a person has recovered from the impact of a concussion? Are there tests or scans that can be done that offer some concrete evidence that, let's say, in the case of a professional athlete, they're ready to go back out on the field?
That's a huge debate, because currently what is used is basically the symptoms, a neurological medical test by the clinician. So the clinician seems, based on the symptoms and the physical appearance of that person, that they are fit to go back to play because they don't have any more symptoms. In terms of the sporting field, it's more or less related to the SCAT-5 test. So they do a SCAT-5 test, which is a test that tests the cognitive ability to a certain extent. But mostly it's associated with the symptoms and the symptoms going away. Now, we clearly know that the symptoms are not associated with brain healing. So there's a mismatch in when the symptoms heal versus when the brain heals. And this window, or this mismatch in the window between these two, is what is causing this confusion about recovery of concussion. So your symptoms might go away, but your brain is still healing from that concussion. And how long it takes the brain to heal is something that we need to visualise, which is hard for us to see.
Your current work here at the Queensland Brain Institute is tackling the problem of concussion in sport, including researching changes in biomarkers, or molecules in the blood or saliva, when concussion occurs, with an overall goal of developing a quick and cheap test measuring brain recovery. So how far into this study are you, and what exactly does it all entail?
So looking at the history of concussions and its association with long-term consequences, what I'm really interested in is identifying a way to determine whether the brain has recovered. We know that a single concussion can cause lingering effects on the brain, which means the brain doesn't recover as quickly, and it's very hard to see on conventional, traditional neuroimaging scans. But if we used advanced imaging, we might get a window into really visualising what is happening at the level of the brain and what is happening over time. Which means when we develop a biomarker from the blood or from the saliva, we are more confident that what we're seeing is actually reflecting what's happening in the brain. There's been a lot of research that's done on biomarkers, but in a multi-trauma setting, or in a sports setting where you get different types of injuries at the same time, in addition to the knock to the head, you'll get a systemic response or changes in biomarkers from the whole body. How do we know that what we're seeing in these biomarkers that are coming from the saliva or the blood are not a response just from the systemic body and our brain specific? And what I'm really targeting is marrying the neuroimaging, where we get a definite window into the brain and be able to see what changes are happening in the brain with the biomarker, to really know that this biomarker is reflecting what's happening at the level of the brain, and, you know, for sure say that when a person has recovered from a concussion, they actually really have.
And so who have you got helping you with this study, and what do they need to do? Is it the case that they need to come in and have sort of certain things measured at the start and then a periodic check, or how does it exactly work?
So to be able to monitor these serial changes or the trajectory of recovery, we really need the players to come in at specific time points after the injury. We know that in the sporting field at the moment, it's around a 2-week mark where players are put back on the field if they're clear of symptoms. And this is sort of standard practice across different clubs. So what we're targeting to do is actually monitor players over time after they've had a concussion. So we bring them in for a scan before they've had a concussion. And then after they've had a concussion, they come back at 3, 7, 14 and 30 days. And basically what that allows us to do is probe that change over time. And with this probing technique, we're able to determine that it is a specific change. Milder concussions might cause biomarkers to level off way earlier than more severe concussions, but we can actually define the severity of that concussion. We can define how long it's taken for them to recover. And this can be generalized to the larger population, where people who have concussions, even not in the sporting field, it can be used as a marker to determine whether the concussion severity is low and whether they've come back to normal. And this is really to prevent longer-term consequences, because we know from the studies that have been done so far the effects of repeated concussions, especially if the brain hasn't recovered.
Is there a specific type of sports person that you need? Does it have to be someone who's playing sort of professional sport, or can it be someone who does maybe social sports? And is there any age range or gender specifics that you need for this study?
For this specific study, we're targeting contact sports players just because they're a higher risk population for getting a concussion. And because of the nature of this specific study, where we need them to come back multiple times, which means that we need to get them to come to volunteer for a baseline scan where they haven't had a concussion for at least 3 months. And then after they've had a concussion, they'd have to come back. And so for you to define a specific population, it would have to be defined for this specific study. Clearly, it would generalize to the wider population for anybody who's doing social sports or at the community level sports. But for this specific one, we're really targeting a population where they're heavily engaged in sports and not on a regular basis.
And for anyone out there who's interested in taking part, what do they need to do in terms of getting in touch or volunteering their services?
So we've got a webpage on the Queensland Brain Institute website where people can volunteer, and that's, I think, the best way. We've also been in contact with club managers, which means that if they just put an expression of interest in the club, we'll be able to hear about that. Clearly, we're hoping that people would volunteer for our study through the website, and then we'll get in contact with them.
Now, we've mostly been focusing on sports people in relation to head injuries, but of course many non-athletes also have experience with this type of thing, from people who've been in car accidents and victims of one-punch attacks to children who've just fallen over while playing. You've done some work with the Defence Force examining concussed patients who've been impacted by bomb blasts. What can you tell me about that research?
So it was really some of the early work that I'd done in brain injury, specifically blast injury, when I was in Singapore. We contracted with the defence organisation in Singapore. They were really vested in understanding the safety profile of their breaches as part of their regular training in the defence. They really wanted state-of-the-art methods to identify how long it takes their personnel to recover from the bomb blast. And so we had breaches come in at baseline before they actually went for their training. And then after the training, they came in at 1, 3, 7, 14, 30 days, and then 6 months. And then we followed them up to 3 years. It was a very intense study because they had to come in specifically on those same days. And they got about an hour and a half of scans, where we collected a lot of state-of-the-art data that you wouldn't collect in a normal clinical setting. And interestingly, on a conventional, what we call a T1 weighted scan or an MRI scan, which is just gives you an image of your brain, the brain looks completely normal. They don't suffer too much symptoms. Some of them used to get a bit of eye bleeds, but in terms of cognitive function, none of them had any symptoms post the training blast that they had on that day. But we could see ongoing deficits in how the different brain regions talk to each other, which we call a method called functional connectivity. It's a means where we map the different connections between different brain areas. What we showed is there is a reduction in how different regions talk to each other over time, and this is persistent up to 3 years post-injury. Interestingly, the first blast is really the one that has the major impact, and you find that it sort of seems like the brain primes itself because their threshold is much lower when they get their second one. It just seems like there's an internal process that allows them to become a bit more immune to the blast and more regulated towards it.
What sort of long-term impact could that then have on a soldier, for example, who's been exposed to several bomb blasts, who's maybe done a number of tours and is a career soldier perhaps?
I mean, I know, and the literature is very vast on this, that, you know, it is a high-risk population and it is an occupation that's associated with these risks. Clearly, identifying the trajectory and how often they can get blasted is one thing where we can minimise that risk. Just like concussions, I think the data is out there to show that there are long-term consequences from repeated blasts, just from war victims and war personnel. But I think there's not enough data out there to show how we can minimise that risk. But maybe from this study that we've done, we can definitely see that reducing the number of repeated impacts within a specific time frame would make a huge difference to how it progresses and its effect on the brain.
Now, in the past 10 or 20 years, we've come to learn a lot about the long-term consequences of concussion, particularly when looking at former NFL players in the United States. How significant is the link between head injuries, multiple concussions, and conditions like dementia?
Recently, it's become quite common. There have been thousands of studies that have been done just in the past decade, really, where NFL players were shown to have brains that look like Alzheimer's disease brains post-mortem. They were getting dementia symptoms very early on at the age of 40 and 50, which is something that we normally don't see in an Alzheimer's patient before the age of 65. And so this is what really triggered this huge leap in trying to understand what are the reasons for that. I can say that there's been two really big studies where they've shown that there is a link with dementia. What the frequency of those repeated concussions, and specifically in repeated concussions, what the frequency of those repeated concussions need to be able to lead to long-term consequences, what the associated factors that cause long-term consequences and early onset of dementia is really not known. So you'll find somebody who plays rugby or contact sports all their life and they live a very healthy aging life, and you find somebody else who gets three concussions and they really suffer persistent symptoms that just diminish their quality of life. And so how we'd know or how we can predict which trajectory or the other is something that is really now the focus of all the studies that are being done around the world. It's just really hard to tell. And we don't know what the factors are, but we definitely know that there is a link.
So like many things, increased awareness often leads to improved clinical management. Up to now, what sort of inconsistency have we seen in the diagnosis, assessment and treatment of concussion? And where do you see it going in the next, say, 5 to 10, even 20 years?
I think it's been something that has been really hard in terms of clinical diagnosis. As I said, if you have a very severe concussion, the medical practitioners can treat that on the spot because they can see it. They know they treat the symptoms. But in terms of those who suffer persistent symptoms, it's really hard first to say who is going to suffer persistent symptoms for weeks and months down the track. Also very hard to know what the biological underpinning of those symptoms are. How do we understand what is happening in the brain to cause these long-term symptoms and why? And this is something that's been a huge dilemma. It's really interesting. There was a big study which was done to determine the link between loss of consciousness, because it's when somebody has loss of consciousness on the field that we really, you know, give them our full major attention. And when there's no loss of consciousness, we seem to think that it's less of a severe concussion. And there was a big study which has been done which showed that no loss of consciousness is associated with a twofold risk in developing early onset of dementia. And that's a huge thing because it tells you the severity of the symptoms that you see at the time of the concussion are not actually related to the long-term consequences. You might get somebody who has had a knock and doesn't suffer long-term loss of consciousness and gets up. And I think they're at a higher risk because they can go back on the field if they pass their clinical examination by the medical practitioner. And those are the ones who are at a higher risk because their brain hasn't recovered. It's undergone a major knock. It's undergone a major change in terms of biological, biochemical processes. And they're being exposed to getting what we call subconcussive injuries, which are the head jittering inside the brain, moving up and down, hitting sides of the skull, not very significant in what we in our terms of an injury, but may actually be cumulative in causing these long-term consequences.
Now, Fatima, I understand that you have quite a personal reason for dedicating your professional life to the study of brain trauma. Your grandmother had dementia and Parkinson's disease, which worsened dramatically after a fall. Now, was it that incident that really drove you into this area of research?
I think it was a significant factor in driving the research to investigate the links between traumatic brain injury and long-term dementia. I've always had a passion for understanding the brain. I've always had a passion for using imaging to be able to look at the brain and investigate changes and develop more ideal methods to be able to image the brain. But I think that was a huge contributing factor in reorienting the type of research that I do, because I had that basic understanding of what happens to the brain following an injury. I just hadn't thought about the fact that it could do so much damage to an ongoing process in the brain.
And have you always had a desire to work in medical research? You said that you're fascinated by how the brain works. Was that even built into you from a child? I know some people feel destined to follow a particular path from when they were children, which is potentially influenced by their parents' hopes for them as well. When did you know this was exactly what you wanted to do and that this was your path to follow?
I think ever since I was a child, I really wanted to be a neurosurgeon. That was my sort of dream career that I wanted to do all along. And it actually wasn't driven by my parents. We don't have a family who's all doctors or anything, but my parents were very education driven. My dad was really somebody who encouraged us to learn more. And I always wanted to be a neurosurgeon, but I went on to do an honours in neuroscience. And this is where I got introduced to neuroimaging, something which I was really fascinated by. And the trajectory just sort of moved more into, you know, applying those methodology and techniques to be able to learn more about the brain.
What other aspects of concussion are you looking at, or are there any sorts of things you'd like to delve into once this study has been completed?
I mean, I have another stream of work where I look into traumatic brain injury, which is just a more significant type of mild injury. In the brain injury field, just as the same as it is with concussion, it's very hard to predict a patient's outcome. It's very hard to predict where you should focus your management, because in terms of clinical management, you know, you might have somebody who, just like in concussion, would get loss of consciousness and probably get up 2 to 3 days later and they're completely fine and their brain's fully recovered. And you get somebody else who really looks minor in the start but then starts to get symptoms weeks down the track. And it's very hard to predict that. And a major portion of my work is looking at prediction of patient outcome from early markers. I am very interested in magnetic resonance imaging, which is MRI, and developing these methods, but I'm more interested in developing something that's more applicable. As you know, MRI is not easy. We don't have easy access to MRI. It's a very expensive method to use. It's not always accessible. You have waiting lists of months at hospitals and imaging centres. And the idea is to use the results that we get from this study to really develop a marker that's from the blood or easy to access, or the saliva, that can replicate what we see on imaging and become that point of care diagnostic.
Well, Fatima, the work that you're doing is obviously invaluable, and it will be interesting to hear more about the progress on that current research as time passes. Thank you very much for taking the time to enlighten us about concussion and head injuries today.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you'd like to learn more or support the work we do at the Queensland Brain Institute, head to qbi.uq.edu.au. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening.